Robin was unappreciated in Canada for almost his entire life.
Yeah, well, he came at a time that was awkward for him. I mean, if he'd come earlier or maybe later, you know. But that was a time when Canadian literature was really being promoted in the academies. And, I mean, that effort to have Canadian studies and have build up a Canadian canon, that was a big deal in Canada at mid-century. If I can illustrate it quickly, one of my mother's school books, which would go to the, you know, earlier parts of the 20th century, to mm-hmm. put it politely, is called, you know, something like A Canadian Garden of Verse. It starts with Rudyard Kipling. Goes on to Whitman, you know? Excuse me? So the idea that there was a Canadian literature that was being promoted and created. I'm not saying that started in the 50s and 60s, but it certainly was making its way into university departments. When I first entered university in the 70s, there wasn't a separate Canadian studies program, you know? So it was a time where the push was on. And for somebody who was grounded in San Francisco, grounded in American poetry, grounded in American classic literature, like Hawthorne, Poe, Dickinson, Whitman, Melville, you know, this wasn't exactly the place to be. He was understood to be kind of American interloper. Yeah.
And the Tisch people had stirred up some shit that pissed off a lot of nationalist poets.
They did. Right. Yes, they did. There was a kind of East-West divide. And so in the East, Northrop Frye was a big name, and he had promoted Canadian literature in his book, The Bush Garden. There was Margaret Atwood, Survival. Those were books, thematic books. So really, the argument came down to this. Let's get Canadian literature on the table. That's what the Canadian professors were saying at that point, and a lot of Canadian writers too, right? What the Tisch people, I think George Bowring would be an important name here, and Robin himself would support, was that, okay, well, you know, Canadian content isn't necessarily what Canada is all about. You know, I mean, just to say you plug a maple leaf in here, does that make it Canadian? It's more like Britlet to me. You know, that's what Bowring would say. Whereas they were after method. That is, the projective verse presents a certain method. And if you take that method to Canada, you're going to get Canadian poetry.
Right.
But the more nationalist poets didn't go with that. It had to be Canadian content. You had to tell the settler story. And in retrospect, that looks a little bit quaint. Because the settler story, you know, now when it's put alongside the whole history of colonialism and the destruction of indigenous peoples and so on, looks a little bit, you know,
white supremacist.
Exactly. Not maybe like it's quite the whole story,
right.
You know. So, but in the 60s and 70s, that was going on. And so Robin, apart from his circle, you know, his student fans and the poets that came up through his classes and became important poets in their own rights, his friends and so on. Other poets didn't seem to have a problem with him, but the academics did.
Right.
And they expressed that by not expressing anything, with just silence.
Right, passive aggression.
Yeah.
And then he comes here and he's not waving the flag, but he's putting out magazines called Pacific Nation. So
yeah.
Another... slap in the face to a proud Canadian nationalist.
Yeah.
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 Can you talk a little bit about that? Were there two editions of
two? There were two. There's only two.
Yeah.
You know, he started the first Pacific Nation was going to be this journal where he would kind of move forward on the whole work of projective verse, and Olson was going to contribute, and all the New Americans were going to contribute. And then, you know, about the second edition.
Olson's dead.
Yeah.
Does this, when I hear about this...
Well, that's not quite true. He Olson is alive for the second edition, but that's where it ended. There were two editions. One came out in 67, one came out in 69. And then Olson died in 1970. So that's the more the, like the chronology. But Robin said in conversation that he couldn't hold up both ends. He couldn't do the professorship at Simon Fraser and do the magazine. Well, if not, why not? Because that's the way he did things. Because he did them slow and he did them carefully. And so he just could not, he was incapable of banging anything out. He couldn't do it.
Couldn't sustain it.
He couldn't do it. He would, you know, he would work for hours and hours and hours on his lectures.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I get a huge whiff of bioregionalism when I think about that.
Yeah.
Is that, do you think in part that was what he was after?
At Pacific Nation? Well, was he after that? Or was it more like, you know, the Spicerian nation, a nation of poetry, a nation of the kind of ideal polis space? I'm not sure that there isn't some of that in there too.
Right.
Because, I mean, Pacific Nation, if one of the first people he contacted about it was Olson. Olson wasn't glossy, it was the other, you know, it wasn't Pacific, it was Atlantic. So it was a nation maybe, but a nation of poets.
Right.
Yeah.
And we're here in Vancouver with the Tallmans, Ralph Maud, and his Charles Olson Memorial Society.
Yeah.
You are Robin's literary executor and Robert Duncan's current literary executor, Peter Quartermain, also lives here. You have Tish here. You have the 1963 Vancouver Poetry Conference. What is it about the water here?
I don't know.
There's something going on, isn't there?
Well, there seems to be a north-south connection. People have commented on that. You know, that there is a line, seems to be an exchange between Vancouver and San Francisco, Vancouver and Oregon. So poets in those areas. I mean, you don't hear about Frank O'Hara hanging out in Vancouver. He sure didn't. Not that I know of, anyway. But the San Francisco poets did. You know, Michael McClure came.
His archives are at Simon Fraser.
Yeah, and I mean, well, Olson came for the conference, but that was a very particular event that he was invited to come to. In terms of the exchange, I think there is a north-south exchange. In some ways, Cascadia, that region, the Cascade region, the Pacific Northwest region, has got more in common, as you say, bioregionalism, with people on other both sides of the border than it does with the East Coast, you know?
Right.
So there might be some of that in there. Localism is coming out of Spicer, you know, for sure. And how you interpret that, whether it's geographical or whether it's intellectual, I think you can read it both ways. You want... Robin wanted a discourse for that journal. He wanted all those voices brought together, brought forward. He wanted young people brought in. He wanted to further the discourse of projective verse. And then it kind of all fell apart.
Besides you, Hannah Arendt,
yeah.
Pauline Oliveris,
mm-hmm.
there didn't seem to be a lot of female companions in Robin's life. I mean, at least not as his work would reflect.
Mm. Well, there was Grandmother Sophia. She was the big one. She started it all, you know. He really loved his grandmother a lot and relied on her and learned from her. So she was a really figure of, you know...
Foundational
figure for him.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of other women in his life, he loved women. And I know how that sounds. I know if you put that in writing... It sounds like, oh, some of my best friends are, you know? It's going to sound like that.
When did you stop beating your wife? Kind of
yes,
a, kind
exactly,
of context,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, but he, you know, Mary Butts was one that mm-hmm. was important to him. I think Robin had no problem at all with acknowledging the powers of women as artists and writers and you know, creator, Sappho, you know. I don't think he ever had a problem with that. And he liked to hang out with women. In terms of where are they in the genealogy of his, you know, like who stands alongside Pound? Well, there's HD.
Right.
You know, there's HD. She was a very important person for mm-hmm. Duncan. Robin liked the ladies at Left Bank. Mary Butts. He wrote a big long essay on Mary Butts. Mm-hmm. So there were there certainly were women in there, but also this is a generation that took off from Pound. Right. And so Pound, you know, Pound was the Everest that they decided to climb way back in 1944 in Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And I still think he's a, you know, whatever, however out of favor Pound may be.
He invented modernism.
I think he's extremely important, yeah. Foundational to modernism.
How does one get to see the 1991 Ralph Maud film, Robin Blazer, in Vancouver?
You just asked Tony Powers.
Okay, all right.
It's up there.
All right.
It is up there. You can watch that film. They have viewers. You can go into the, there's a room in Special Collections, and they will set you up. I don't know whether it's VHS still or what it is. It might be. But if whatever it is,
they've got to digitize that and put it on YouTube.
They can play it.
With the Line of Shatter. That needs to be online as well.
Yeah.
The 1963 Vancouver Portrait Conference film. What's Robin's legacy? The biggest three-word question you're ever going to get.
Oh, boy, that is a very big one. What is the legacy? Well, that's going to be my next project, to figure that out.
Is that right?
Well, in a very loose way, I mean, I don't think right now I'm going to do another Robin piece, but to try to think through where a literary art needs to go right now, that is the thing. And the place I'd start is what I said way back when, before we were actually recording. I would start with the contemporary concept of public space. What does that mean? What does open space mean now in the age of the internet? Certainly all the definitions, the, you know, the conceptualization of it have to be thought through and made explicit. Right? And I haven't done that yet. I really need to think about that, what a public space might be in these days.
Well, the key word in relation to where we go with it is practice, you said.
Yes. Well, that's not me. That's Peter Sloterdijk.
But you resonate with it.
I resonate with it, and I have to think through the implications of it. You know, what does it mean to have a poetry of practice, a poetry of, you know, the practice of everyday life, maybe? What does that mean? And how does it have torque in an age like this one, where everything is so heavily, heavily mediatized? Everything is so mediated, too, you know, that you can't... what is an experience is not an experience, I'll take a selfie of it.
Right.
You know, everything has to be run through the machine and run back. But this is not an easy conversation to have, because the instant I say that, I can see, well, okay, but that's what the old deconstructionists said too. They said, you know, there's no unmediated experience. You're not going to get an unmediated experience. But I think where Robin will take me, or anyone who reads them carefully, is the next step is that, okay, but unfortunately you still do have experiences. And let's figure out how to deal with it. So how to live as opposed to what you can know. And maybe that is what Peter Sloterdijk meant with practice. We're not so concerned about what you can know or taking apart what you think you know and actually you don't know. So all the psychoanalysts and the deconstructive philosophers been very, very successful in telling us what we think we know and what actually we don't know, because it's all been, you know, mediated for us. How to live. For me, that's a really key question. How do you live in these particular times? And that implies practice.
How do you live in these times?
With a pillow over my head, maybe? heads firmly stuck in hole. Terrifying. It's really terrifying. You know, I've left the university. I retired from the university as of the 31st of August, 2019. And yes, it was time for me to go because I'm of retirement age, you know. But on the other hand, the university has sufficiently changed so that I felt that I could no longer in conscience stay there unless I completely reimagined my teaching practice. When I joined up, what I signed up for was scholarship, you know, and I kind of, high scholarship is how far you can push your mind. But there are so many other factors that are at work in universities these days. Teaching people how to survive, how to stay alive, how to get a job, how to negotiate a world that is culturally and technologically complex beyond the grasp of most of us. So, you know, that implies a different objective.
The objective now, professionalism.
Yeah. I'm trying not to be negative, Paul, but there is a downside to this, you know. Yeah.
I could go to points in the book where Robin was articulating this.
Yeah.
Or you were articulating it through Robin's experience.
Yes, yeah.
But would you want to read a poem of his to end the thing? Do you think there...
Let me see now.
You know, there's one that I particularly
okay.
like.
Oh, good.
That is that one there. I don't know. Do you think that's a good one to end on?
Oh, sure. What would you do if all the lovers of your years passed by at midnight, dressed in the flesh they wore when you last loved them? What do I do? What do I say? I loved you then. I touch you now with all the glow you left in the palm of my hands.
I'm really grateful for your time and your scholarship. This book is brilliant, and I'm really grateful that I've had this experience to talk to you about it and pick your brain. It's remarkable. It's a life's work. It's fantastic. And the idea that you are not, your work is not done yet is very inspiring.
Thank you, Paul, and I appreciate ever so much your careful reading of this book and your attention to it. Robin used to define that kind of attention as true love. That's what he meant by poetic love. It's attention to something like that, and I'm very grateful.